This is the podcast, Constitutions for Democracy, from the Albert Hitchman Center on Democracy and the Cost Action, Constitution Making and Deliberative Democracy. I'm Janina Well, and together with experts on the topic, I will explore the main challenges constitutions face nowadays. We are interested in constitutions as pillars of democracy. However, a constitution could also play the opposite role, consolidating authoritarianism. Thus, we need to understand how hybrid and authoritarian regimes perceive and promote constitutions, as well as the role they attribute to the will and the voice of the people. In this second episode, we want to explore why non-democratic regimes quite often do engage in elaborating constitutions, and why they sometimes do promote or simulate the promotion of citizens' engagement in participatory processes. Why, if they seem to govern without restrictions, would be interested in changing the rules? Participation is just a smokescreen, or does it play a strategic role? Can it lead to the opening of the system sooner or later? The song Chile, la alegría ya viene was part of the 1988 campaign of the opposition to Augusto Pinochet in Chile during the plebiscite. We selected it because the case is central for our discussion today and because I have an expert and a very dear colleague from the country.
I am Claudia Heiss, PhD in politics from the New School for Social Research, currently head of the Political Science undergraduate program at Universidad de Chile, author of the book Why Do We Need a New Constitution in Spanish, as well as articles and book chapters on constitutionalism and Chilean politics.
Welcome, Claudia. In 1980, Pinochet, installed in power since 1973 after the coup d'etat against President Salvador Allende, promoted a constitutional replacement. Why he did it if the authoritarian regime was consolidated?
Pinochet wanted to radically modify Chilean politics towards the future in order to make it impossible for something like the Salvador Allende project of a democratic way towards socialism to ever happen again. This transformative project was clear from day one after the military coup in September 11, 1973. Only days after the coup, the dictator called on a group of constitutional lawyers loyal to the regime to draft a new constitution in order to limit the role of the state in the economy, thus setting the basis for neoliberalism, to limit pluralism, and to institutionally protect this regime from future change by giving the armed forces the role of guardians of the constitution. During the 70s, several constitutional drafts were published, and in 1980, Pinochet organized a bogus plebiscite to grant legitimacy to these texts. In a context of human rights violations and the proscription of political parties with no electoral rolls and no independent oversight of any kind, the Constitution obtained 67% approval. Once in place, the Constitution did not immediately become the basic norm. Instead, it stated an 8-year period where 29 transitory dispositions would be in place, allowing for broad discretionary power by the military junta. After this period, the protected democracy established in the 1980 constitution was supposed to begin functioning with a Senate controlled by appointed legislatures, with the socialist and communist parties constitutionally banned, with exile still in place, and this, among other many features, completely incompatible with true democracy. Many of these rules were in the end modified to allow for the transition to democracy in 1990. In fact, because of external and internal social pressure, the election of 1988 established in the constitution became a real plebiscite with international oversight, and Pinochet was defeated by 56% of the voters. 1 year later, 54 amendments to the constitution were approved in a new plebiscite in July 1989. With this amended text, which maintained many undemocratic features, Chile started its way back to democratic rule.
An interesting point emerged when considering that despite repression and control, sometimes the room opens for democratic changes. It happened in Chile. The Pinochet's constitution was made at closed doors, but then there were two plebiscites, one for ratification, described by Claudia, and the second one that to somehow play the role of an election, although with no alternative candidate. The 1990 constitution introduced the obligation of calling a second plebiscite 8 years later, and this one opened the door to the restoration of democracy. Claudia, how do you explain it and its unexpected result?
First, it has to be clear that the 1980 plebiscite was not a participatory mechanism restraining the political power of the military. In fact, Robert Barros, in his book Constitutionalism and Dictatorship, was a pioneer in studying the limitations of power during the Pinochet regime. And he found that the only true limiting powers during the constitutional debates that led to the 1980 constitution were among the four military branches. The commanders-in-chief of the army, the air force, and Carabineros police did have, Barros argues, a limiting role over the preferences by the army chief general Augusto Pinochet. Political parties, popular participation did not matter at all, not even in the 1980 plebiscite. But you are right that the situation was different in 1988. The constitution was not supposed to call for a plebiscite asking, do you want Pinochet to continue for 8 more years or have immediate free elections? But this is exactly what the 1988 plebiscite became due to the force of political events. The original schedule of the constitution wanted 1988 to be the moment where the military junta would submit to the country a presidential candidate for an 8-year period. At that point, Pinochet expected to inaugurate a new form of political normalcy, overcoming the emergency period of the dictatorship. Instead, the economic crisis, intense social mobilization, and international pressure all played a role in pushing the authoritarian regime to negotiate with the opposition the realization of the 5 October 1988 yes or no plebiscite, which is today signaled as the date of the beginning of the transition to democracy. There is significant evidence that the dictatorship hesitated to deliver the true results of the plebiscite until the last minute, but the reduction of political support by economic interests and by some even on the political right made untenable to lie over the electoral results and to maintain Pinochet at the head of the government. In July 1989, a reform to the constitution negotiated between the incoming opposition and the military obtained 91% approval. This made possible the legalization of leftist political parties, ended exile of thousands of Chileans, and allowed for the December 1989 presidential and parliamentary elections, where Christian Democrat Patricio Elwin was elected for a 4-year period.
The Chilean plebiscite led to the transition. Context matters, and more than 30 years after this democratic wave, it looks like the world is facing a wave on the opposite direction, towards autocratization. Among these, Hungary and Poland are the only EU member states against which the Article 7 procedure of the Treaty of the European Union was initiated to prevent the systemic threat to the Union's founding values. In September, the EU published the 2020 Rule of Law, which highlighted the declining levels of the rule of law in both countries. The VDM Democracy Report 2020 shows that Hungary has been among the top 10% of autocraticizing countries between 2009 and 2019. Let us talk to an expert to understand what is going on there.
My name is Daniel Roche. I'm a research fellow of Center for Social Science, Institute for Political Science in Budapest. And my current research topic is about political parties and democratic innovations in Hungary. So in this topic, I have published several articles. And one of the most recent articles is dealing exactly with a very specific form of instrumental use of deliberation in Hungary, which is a national consultation.
There are several concrete examples of how Viktor Orban has undermined the independence of the judiciary and challenged political and human rights, such as elections, the right to asylum, and the right to assembly. At the same time, he is promoting legal changes, including mechanisms of citizen participation. How and why?
So, for example, in 2000, 2015, the Hungarian government asked citizens whether and what they think about the situation of migration in Hungary and whether migrants from Syria should be welcome or not. Or in 2011, the government sent another questionnaire about the future constitution of Hungary. So very broad topics, but these kind of invitations include 12 or 13 questions to the citizens. And well, originally, as they evolved over the time, we see that originally there was answer options, and over the years they got simplified into a yes and no questions. So that's why I argue that this kind of deliberation actually is like more like an instrumental use of the deliberation. And in some cases, as in these two cases that I mentioned, they are also linked to direct democracy. In 2015, it was linked to a referendum on terrorism and migration. And in 2011, actually, national consultation was used in order not to call a referendum on the constitution, which the government considered to be too complex for citizens. So instead of a referendum, citizens were invited to answer these 12 questions. So this very instrumental use of deliberation actually has two strategic goals from the side of the government. On the one hand, it's about vote seeking and policy seeking. So we see clear examples how national consultation actually helps the government party to keep its popularity in the population, and also how much it helps the government to set the agenda and actually control the political agenda for a longer period. And it has also a very normative objectives, which is actually making the decisions of the government more legitimate. On the one hand, sometimes it is a tool, as I mentioned, to start a referendum, or in other case, it can be also a way to avoid referendums where the public perceives it as necessary. So it's a kind of smokescreen to this kind of political procedure.
And what about Russia? How do you read current developments? Is the referendum of 2020, which among other issues allowed Vladimir Putin to run again for two more 6 years presidential term, banned same-sex marriage, and placed the constitution above internal law, just a smoke screen?
I truly find that the 2020 referendum was actually a smokescreen. Not being an expert on Russia, I just want to highlight two, three points which are quite obvious, and I think it's very easy to detect for anybody who is dealing with the topic. So the very first thing is that actually in 2020, legally speaking, it was not a referendum, but it was called an all-Russian vote, which is already a kind of difficult thing to judge whether this new form of something that is not called referendum is legally binding, or how is it legally binding. So anyway, I just would like to stress that the format did not follow the actual legislation, and referring to the uncertain times of COVID is just, I don't think that it's an enough argument to change the legal rules. So, you know, the rule of law as a principle should prevail and should not be tortured in a way that somebody creates a new procedure just because of a very unexpected phenomenon happening. So this is the first reason. Other reason is that it was a very vague referendum. So it was not only about one topic, but like changing the whole constitution. And as such, it would have required a much more detailed public debate than it actually happened. So it was a very, very one-sided public discussion that happened, and the media did not really represent both sides of arguments in this discussion. And another extra example to show how little expertise was valued in the process. I just want to draw the attention that even the Central Election Commission had internal problems when the experts of the commission expressed their concerns, and they were actually abolished because of saying this kind of concerns. I think it's a very clear example how less or how little expertise was valued during this campaign, and how little, say, even experts could have about concerns or problems regarding the process.
Let us now consider another non-European case. Turkey. Turkey has a long history of constitutionalism going back to the first Ottoman constitution of 1876. Despite this long tradition, rule of law in the country has remained vulnerable to military coups and authoritarian temptations. The current constitution was enacted under military rule in 1982 and has been amended nearly 20 times. However, the introduction of a presidential system by Recep Tayyip Erdogan through a controversial referendum in 2017 has brought an end to debates about liberal constitution making of previous decades. We have today a colleague from the Coast Action, an expert on the case, to better understand Turkey.
I'm Volkan Gül. I'm an assistant professor at Kütahya Dumlupınar University in Turkey. And my research area is generally deliberative democracy, citizen participation, and deliberative democratic practices.
Volkan, have constitutions played a major role in Turkey's history?
Constitutions are an important part of political discussion in Turkey. It is a highly valued document, literally meaning main law or mother law. Turkey had four constitutions, and these constitutions were coincided with new beginnings. First one was in 1921, right after the National Assembly founded. It was a limited constitution with few articles. In 1924, another constitution was drafted, and for many, this is the real first constitution, as it was more comprehensive than the previous one. Third constitution was drafted in 1961 after the military coup in 1960. It is the most liberal constitution in Turkey has had. It provided many freedoms and rights. Although it was amended in 1970, it remained in effect until 1982. This constitution, drafted after the military coup in 1980, it restricted many freedoms and rights granted by the constitution of 1961. Today, it is the constitution in effect, and it has been amended 19 times so far. Not all amendments require a referendum, though. Although there are technical rules about it, it also seems to depend on the issue and the political environment. It's important to note that the fourth article of the constitution states that the first three articles, which are related to Turkey as a republic, its characteristics as a republic, and the symbols of Turkey's state, cannot be amended, and it bans any proposal to change them. In any case, today all political parties are in favor of breaking away from this constitution. AKP has been using a discourse of new Turkey in different contexts, and constitutional reform is no exception. We had three constitutional referendums under the AKP rule. All three referendums passed and brought important changes. It is important to note that in all three referendums, items are grouped in one package, and so the voting was for the package rather than individual items. 2007 referendum can be seen as a first step towards today's presidential government system. The package included the direct election of the president, the intervals of presidential and parliamentary elections, and also quorum required for the parliament to meet. In 2010, the package was even larger, including very different and unrelated items, such as right to personal application to the constitutional court, changing the structure of constitutional court and the council of judges and prosecutors, and also enabling the trial of the generals of 1980 military coup. The final referendum was a total system change. The package included changing the parliamentary system to a sort of presidential system, increasing the number of MPs in the parliament, and changes to the structure of the council of judges and prosecutors. When we look at these referendum processes, we can easily see that new Turkey discourse and the changes with constitutional referendums are part of AKP's strategy to achieve the political system it has wanted. Today, the presidential system in Turkey is a one-man rule. The powers of the executive consolidated in the president, checks and balances are weakened, and the president as the head of the state is no longer unpartisan. The president can be a party leader, as in the case of Erdogan.
Concentration of power in hands of the leaders as the goal. However, some political support seems to be always required, or at least performed. In Turkey, the tool for such people's ratification has been the referendum. How do you explain it?
Referendums has always been a legitimating method in Turkey. Even the 1961 and 1982 constitutions, which were both drafted after military coup and under the military rule, were ratified by a referendum. Similarly, for the current government, referendums are claimed to show the popular support for the government. And the result of a referendum is argued to be the will of the nation, and the concerns of the losing side limited, even non-existing. This way, referendums contributes to the majoritarian and polarized political landscape of Turkey. In addition, the government argues that the result of a referendum is not only a victory for Turkish democracy, but also a victory against the opposition parties, who are labeled as terrorists or military coup supporters during campaigning. In the end, the nation teaches them a lesson by rectifying the government's proposal. However, there are constant issues like campaigning inequalities and the lack of media coverage for the opposition. In addition to these, in 2017, Higher Electoral Commission accepted non-official ballot papers as valid. This was a decision made during the voting process. For the opposition, these clearly undermine the legitimacy of the referendum process and so the legitimacy it purports to provide to the result. However, for the government, the main concern is who wins. In recent years, there were some efforts to involve public in constitution making. One was the formation of Constitutional Conciliation Commission. Although the overall format is an elite deliberation about the constitution, input from different actors and organizations and citizens are collected, either via holding meetings or online channels. However, their input was not integrated much. The second attempt was a collaborative effort of Constitutional Conciliation Commission and Economic Policy Research Foundation of Turkey. 13 roundtable meetings were organized in 12 different cities between 2011 and 2012. These meetings were intended for citizen discussion about a new constitution. Although hundreds of citizens took part in the discussions, the initiative was not successful as a way to engage citizens in a meaningful way. The reports derived from the meetings were sent to the political parties in the parliament. However, they were not considered. Therefore, they can be seen as informal consultations with no real impact.
In this second episode, we explore why some non-democratic regimes do engage in elaborating constitutions and why they sometimes do promote or simulate the promotion of citizens' engagement in participatory processes. Why, if they seem to govern without restrictions, could be interested in changing the rules? The short answer is because also dictators need information and control on present and future options. It is rare for dictators to step down, but when they do accept it, is because they have a feasible alternative. So, constitutions are expected to provide future solutions for the members of the regime, as well as some form of legitimacy. Even more, they need to perform in front of potential domestic opponents, sometimes also within the regime, an international pressure that they do have social support. And we do observe it all around the world. We mentioned in this episode the cases of Chile, Hungary, Russia, and Turkey. It has also been observed recently in other cases as different and distant as Morocco and Cuba. In Morocco, inspired by the Arab Spring, the youth movement February 20 called for the opening of the regime. King Mohammed VI activated repression and a reform process calling for participation. In Cuba, in 2018, a massive participatory process took place and thousands of meetings organized. Despite being different in many aspects, both processes share in common that were controlled by the government and there was no plural discussion. Both were ratified by referendum. Participation is a smokescreen. The idea is to engage the public in constitution making, but without independent voice and no real impact. Join us in a brand new conversation every month on any podcatcher of your choice by searching Constitutions for Democracy and subscribe so you can get the latest updates on our episodes and our research.